listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast where we discuss classic works of management and organization studies. Welcome to episode 60, where we are discussing Joan Woodward's classic book, Industrial Organization, Theory and Practice, originally published in 1965. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is part one of the episode, which we've subtitled, Not All Industrial Organizations Are Alike. This is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
Hi, this is Greta calling from Oxford in the United Kingdom.
This is Fridtjof calling from Delft in the Netherlands.
Hi, this is Leonardo calling from São Paulo, Brazil.
Welcome, everybody, and a special welcome to Leonardo, who is joining us for the first time. Yeah, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself?
It's a great pleasure to be here. First of all, I hold a PhD in sociology from the University of São Paulo here in Brazil. And I have worked with issues of innovation and public policy. And now, currently, I'm working with a nonprofit organization that deals with IP addresses here in Brazil and the .br and address with what, if you want a web page, .br.com.br, you have to talk with us. And inside this organization, we have surveys, and I manage a survey that deals with internet use among enterprises here in Brazil. So I'm dealing every day with the how enterprises here in Brazil are trying to use the internet and try to apply the digital transformation on their routines. So I think I can give an idea of how companies in a developed country are trying to thrive in this, all this digital transformation that we're talking about. So I think it's a great place to look at theory and try to understand it and on the reality in a country that have so many challenges ahead. So that's it, I think. I was a listener, and so I'm very proud and honored to be here now as a part of the podcast. Thank you so much.
Welcome, Leonardo. That's wonderful to hear a bit about your background.
Okay. Thank you very much, Leonardo, and welcome. What I'd like to do now is turn our attention to this episode's text, which is another classic work. It's called Industrial Organization, Theory and Practice, and it's by Joan Woodward. Just as a quick overview of what the text is about, this was the result of a long stretch of study of the industrial organizations that had cropped up in a particular section of, southeastern England, South Essex. And what she was doing was leading a research team to look at basically the character, the performance of the industries in that area. And it was done in sort of using a case study approach. And just to really briefly overview, because we'll go through this book in much more depth in a moment. But part one gives details of the industrial organization as understood at the time. Like, what were the variables that typically separated one type of firm from another, or the understanding of one type of firm from another? And the setting in terms of, you know, how did this area grow so rapidly in these organizations with all these industries popping up? The technologies, the measures of success. So all of those were sort of laid out in what was part one prior to the case study. This is what the state of our understanding of organizations were, and this is what we're going to do with the case study. Part two went into the case studies themselves, in which they looked at things like the relationships between development, production, and marketing, recalibrated their thinking in terms of what did they learn about the measures of success or all of the technical variables that they went into the case studies thinking about. And then after the initial set, they went in and did follow-up investigations, and this kind of gets into part three, where they went into some of these firms in greater depth, especially those that were undergoing significant change. Like, they were going from one form of industry to another. For example, if they were a small unit type of a production where it was very specialized custom type products, and then they went to mass production, like they grew to mass production, that case illuminated some interesting facets of change. And then it concludes with, and well, this is what we learned. This is sort of toward an organization theory based on all of these cases. The study of the book certainly has had some significant enduring value, and this particular version that we're reading is one that included an introduction by a couple of other scholars who laid out what was the impact. Greta, do you want to go ahead and talk about that?
Sure. Yes. So we're the version I read, and I guess you guys as well, is the 1980 version of the book. Like the original version got published by 1965, and the 1980 version is kind of a second edition to it. And as you may know, Joan Woodward passed away, unfortunately, rather early in her career. I think it was 1972. So the 1980 edition, when a lot of her ideas got picked up, she wasn't there anymore to continue the line of research. And so the version that we read includes an introduction by Sandra Dawson and Dorothy Wedderburn to kind of describe the work of Joan Woodward, kind of the emergence of the contingency theory or contingency approach that really she kicked off. See, her work has been foundational in starting the contingency theory line of thinking and area of research. These two scholars do a great job outlining that, as well as the criticisms that started to merge over time and introducing some alternative perspectives. As we discuss the book today, we will point out some of the things that these authors have also brought up in their introduction.
Yeah, and what I would like to add to that is that I think it's a really nice example of how to summarize and understand and put the value of a book in context. And if you don't have the time to read the whole book, I think just the introduction itself, this version that Greta was just talking about, does a really good job at summarizing the whole book and giving you a holistic understanding of what the book is about without, of course, giving all the details, which obviously happens when you do an introduction like this. I like that introduction a lot.
Yeah, yes, it's interesting because it's a time of changing. So because all the industries are beginning to put another type of technology on, so all the landscape of that part of England that she was looking for, she was looking what's changing. So I think it's one of those very special moments when the research is on the right time and on the right place.
Completely agree. And what I also liked about the book is how it's kind of a snapshot of the time of the field of organization studies, and how people came to realize the importance of getting into organizations and really studying how the work is happening. The work that had been done before, for instance, by Taylor, the classical management theory, kind of formed the starting point of this research, but then they also describe like how they set up the study and how they set up the approach of finding firms that would be willing to participate in the research, how they went to the engineering school because they had the connections with industry and they could tap into those connections. I really enjoyed reading that, and then the detailed information provided in the book, how they went about designing the research, selecting their participants, coming to a data set.
So why don't we start diving into the text of the book? And I think the best place to start is the first chapter, or the first couple of chapters, where she talks a lot about the aims and the methods of going at this and formulating the research project. And I think it's very, very interesting because it kind of shows that this came at a very important time where there was significant change in the area. Not just, of course, with the factories, but just the whole area was really undergoing significant change after World War II. And so it was a matter of looking at what was going on with all of these industries.
And I think that's what, from my perspective, trying to look at organization design is so interesting, that she kind of started with this motivation was that she was teaching management, and that there was this idea from Taylor that basically there's this one best way, and that's the scientific way to design a company. And that, of course, once you're sort of say out there, it's like, yeah, but every organization is in a different context. And especially also, for example, regarding technology, there's different things going on that require a difference in the way that you organize the company. So I think all the way in the introduction, in the beginning, I kind of tried to summarize it as commercially successful firms seem to be those in which form and function were complementary, which is for me quite interesting, because one of the key design principles of Didier Rams, a famous designer, is form follows function. So that depending on what you want to achieve with whatever design you're doing, you have to think up how to achieve it. So instead of making things very ornate and very, very beautiful, first try to think about, okay, what are we actually trying to achieve? What is the function that we're trying to do? And then you will think about, okay, how could we actually fulfill that function? And I think what she sort of say nicely shows is that there is not really one best way to organize, but there's different aspects that you need to consider. So like from an organizational design perspective, this is a fascinating piece of work.
Yeah, it also is interesting, just the scope of the research, because when we're talking about this study taking place involving 100 different firms, 100 different organizations of very different types. And this is laid out in the second chapter, where they show you had firms that were what they call predominantly line organizations, which is essentially they're the ones that have primarily just the assembly lines, if you will. The whole organization is there essentially to perform the direct manufacturing function, as compared to, say, functional organizations where it's a little bit different. And then you had the staff line organizations, which was a mix of the line type of activity and staff administration functions that served as enablers, you know, administration and other things. The difference, there were so many differences in terms of so much variation in terms of the types of organizations that they looked at, and also the scope. The same chapter includes various different variables that they looked at of how different organizations or managed control functions, what was the span of control of first line supervisors versus, you know, some organizations, the first line supervisor was responsible for 7 or 10 people. And then I think the largest number was something like 55, 56. So you had a tremendous variation among these 100 firms in terms of just the basics of how were they structured? And so then, you know, the obvious question is, well, does one type of organizational structure work better than another? That was a pretty interesting question to pursue.
Completely agree with that, Tom. And I think like the figure on page 41 nicely illustrates this, the variety in the data set. And so in terms of the research design, which I really, really liked, I think it's good to point out that Joan Woodward and her set of researchers that helped her, they only focused on manufacturing firms. So that was kind of the focus of their study on the organization of manufacturing. And that probably also explains the focus on technology there. What you said, Friedhof, like this idea of that there's not one approach, there might be multiple approaches, and it might be contingent on the nature of the work and the nature of the production process, might also have partly been inspired by a background, which during our professional development workshop at the Academy of Management, we had Sarah Kaplan talking about the work of Joan Woodward, and she gave a very nice overview of the career of Joan Woodward, having also extensive experience and practical insight into the industrial problems at hand at that time, and then going into industry, really having the practical experience from the transformations happening in the field, as well as for that time, a really good understanding of how to set up the research. See, started off with a data set of 203 firms, and her group of researchers spent a minimum of a week inside each firm to complete the survey they had set up for all of them. And this data set was ranging from companies that had less than 100 employees to over 8,000 employees. That's a huge variety of in terms of size. Like you pointed out, Tom, like the different types of production processes that they identified, coming up with these three, kind of three different types that they started to distinguish. I think it's beautiful. And being able to do that type of research at the time, I think is really a strength of the work and got me thinking about how our area of research evolved over time, where we now see much more distinction between, you know, large-based survey research versus small case studies. But I guess we will come back to that later in our discussion.
Yeah, and just to kind of give an idea, I'll just highlight something from the third chapter where she actually lays out the different types of production systems, for example, that were in this sample of industries, essentially arranged in three different categories and perhaps some hybrids in between, where you had some firms that were focused on what she was calling unit and small batch firms, which would be kind of like the custom made products. You would basically expect these to be either highly specialized or special in some way, as opposed to, say, what she was qualifying as the large batch or mass production systems, where you can imagine more like, you know, like the automobiles. Like if you're going to compare custom automobiles versus, say, the straight brand line type of automobiles that would be mass produced that you would see in an ordinary dealership. And then the third one was what they called a process production, in which it was, and this was an interesting way to put it, was where, you know, it's, as opposed to the product being a discrete item that comes off the line, this was the type of firm that produces massive quantities or volume of substances, such as it was primarily chemical, but I could kind of see that there were others where, you know, you say basically you're going to produce, 100,000 liters of gasoline. Well, you know, that would be considered a process. And then there were hybrids in between. So like, for example, you might have a firm that does both mass production and process production. If you had if you were making a function, some sort of a device or a thing that had both mechanical and had some sort of like a chemical component to it. And even within those categories, she was immediately finding among these firms that there were a lot of subcategories along the way. And it's all laid out in this table. And so the variance really shows that there was a very diverse set of industries and situations that were already going in before they even began the case.
Yes, just to add to this, I think it's important to mention that I read some criticisms about the book that it's a theoretical or many descriptions. And getting back to the second chapter, the beginning, she mentions the organic and mechanical organization distinction that I think it's something that is very important to think of. It's a great typology to think how organizations react to change and how they can change. So I think Woodward are looking to organizations through this lens, so that Burns and Walker distinction between mechanical and organical, looking at how organizations deal with uncertainty and how this affects the production. So she made a great job building the typologies of the organizations that she studied, putting on this kind of typology that Burns and Walker did.
And to extend Greta's point on research design, so what I like is that, and I think that's like a limitation also of current research, that because it's a book, she actually takes us through like a whole research design process. So not just we do one run research design, we're done with that, but much more seeing that, you know, there's kind of like a motivation for doing this. There's not just one best way, or at least some doubt. And then you go into it, you have a broad data set, a lot of companies. And then further down the line, you see, okay, wait, there's some issues that we want to tackle qualitatively. And I really like seeing this process of inquiry where basically different kinds of research design are connecting to each other, and especially the going from quant to qualitative. I think that's not something that happens enough or could happen more. And I really like this kind of research design that I guess is very difficult to publish in a journal article. But when you're writing a whole book, then you're really able to describe the whole designing process of research and how different research projects can together still be much more informative.
I also like the fact that because it is a book, that you have the space to tell what's going on in the terms of stories, which is kind of difficult to do in a journal article sometimes. There's a chart, and I'm going to kind of move us now to the part where they actually talk about the results of the cases, and we can move around at will here. But this one chart is just, for me, really summarizes the beauty of the research. And this is on, in the version that we have, it's page 128, but it's basically figure 28 that shows the characteristics of the production systems. And you want to talk about a powerful story being told that shows how different firms behave differently. This shows a very, very stark difference. Because if you're a unit or a small batch, and this is basically laying out how do firms see the relationship between marketing, development, and production. And development is being defined as research and development, the study or the design of new products. And so if you're a unit and a small batch firm, then your first most critical function is development, but marketing precedes it. And essentially you're out there, you know, she tells the story that you're out there trying to sell the promise of a product that you can deliver, because this is going to be a custom-made thing. And you can basically get a smaller number. If you can get enough people to justify making and then producing the product, then you're okay. Meanwhile, mass production, marketing is on the back end. It's like the most important aspect is production itself. You've got to have the research done in order to, beforehand in order to make sure that you have a demographic that's going to buy it. But the marketing happens after production occurs. Meanwhile, process, the chemical type of example, then marketing comes into the middle before you produce, because the way that the production line works is that it's kind of a constant state of production, and you just basically have to have a place to ship these chemicals before you produce. You know, you have to have the, you know, it's a different sequence. And it's really interesting because that, you know, that would by itself suggest that, well, there may be no one best way, but there may be better ways attuned to what type and scope of what a organization is going to produce.
I think in this figure that you say, it's the contingencies, you know, if I understand well, this is the to cope with this difference that your organization will be different as it are dealing with this kind of cycle. Because I was really trying to understand why this book is understood as a contingency theory. So I think this the way to organize will be a result of how you deal with this cycle.
Sounds good. I want to say one more thing about what we liked, and I think that's a natural flow into maybe discussing some of the case studies, if you're okay with that. One thing that I really liked about the book is the detailed descriptions and empirical focus on really the work of the workers on the front lines, what people do and what happens to them. And part of that is reflected in a very simple set of questions that guided the survey research. But I think that's also a strength that really came to bloom in the case studies that are in the second part of the book. And, you know, this real engagement in the field and, I guess what I want to say is that the book illustrates the power of having this very detailed focus on how work happens within firms on the work floor and the importance of that to not miss out on certain variables that matter in terms of how work is organized.
Okay, and I think one of the aspects I also liked about this book that the technology is much more present in the book. at least more in my feeling than in studies nowadays, that, for example, like understanding that, say, if you have a chemical process or a biological process, like with making beer, etc., that it's not something you can just stop, like with other kind of production process, etc. It's like a chemical process. It takes a long time to actually start up. And if something is going wrong, you will have problems for a long time in producing whatever you're making. And giving that technology, so to say, enough space in your book or in your article to actually understand the implications that this technology has on the organizational level, so to say, like on the organizing level. I think that's something that's really valuable. And yeah, of course, this is what the book, I think, really nicely still includes in the descriptions of the cases.
Yeah, I think it's something that really got my attention on the book was the similarities between unit and the process production, when the author talks about how people are specializing on this different kind of productions, but they have many more space for decisions than people that work from the mass production, large batch production. So it's interesting how employment relations are built around how these people, how they important they are, how the status they have on their organization. The people are more able to do their jobs than in the other part of the on this scale than where people are just pressing buttons for save. So it's interesting how she said that from one side, this kind of status came from because in unit, the guy knows how to solve the problem. And on the other side, it's a great because people are more educated. And in the middle, you have the people that are just part of the mechanical process.
Yeah, I also really like that part. And it really got me thinking about the research I've done myself. Particularly the ethnography I did within the Japanese multinational, which was also kind of a manufacturing company. I recall like some of the interviews I did with some of the Japanese line managers explaining the difference in the manufacturing process in Japan and in Europe, in the Netherlands. They were producing the same type of material, but whereas in Japan it was batch-based production, so they could stop the production process at a certain moment and then start it again when sales came in, and whereas in the Netherlands it was continuous production, so they couldn't stop it in the same way. And the people I interviewed were discussing the implications this had for how they managed the plant, how they manage the people. And this kind of, like Woodward's work really got me thinking of, you know, this is still relevant today. And it's so important to focus on the nature of the production process, the nature of the tasks people do, what people try to accomplish, and how that is of impact in the way organizational processes, practices, and structures are developed and are in place, and the different kind of rules of the game within an organization.
And I think that's also, again, like from the perspective of organization design, etc., the book, at least I feel that in a lot of ways, is quite holistic. But like describing these kind of dilemmas, describing these kind of considerations, how, for example, these kind of differences have implications down the line. So it's like it feels in that sense like a much more holistic perspective on organizations than much of the work that we have nowadays, by trying to really, for example, look at the whole anatomy of an organization and still do research on that.
Yes, and it's interesting how it's the sociological background of the author appears here discussing subjects of management, because when she's talking about how workers are alienated in the workplace, how organizations change their values, like what if this organic and mechanical thing, that's a Durkheimian, it's from Durkheim distinction. So it's very interesting how she was able to bring that kind of old discussion, by the time it was already old, to some issues that was of the how England was rebuilding its industry.
Okay, so kind of following on with that, I mean, you know, I'd say I talked a bit about the relationship that they that she derived that shows differences between the type and scope of output against the relationship between certain functions. Part two also included a lot of a fairly long and very detailed chapter about the planning and control of production, and there were some very interesting insights from this chapter as well, because, like, for example, there's when you're talking about, say, a special order firm, which is focused on, like, custom delivery of a high end product or a specialized product, that also has a significant difference or impacts significantly the type of people who you're going to have in the marketing, production, and development side of things. And the tendency is going to be a reliance on, in a special order firm, reliance on individual experts who are, basically the research and development is going to have high expertise. It's going to be a very important function that's central to what they do. And so you expect the individuals there to not only be high expert, but also be high status. But then you go through all of the other examples that she gives in the different types of firms, and you realize that, well, wait a second, you know, the expertise and the higher status is found in different parts of the firm. Say in a mass production, the effectiveness and the expertise of particular individuals might not be as important in the development or the research there. It may be in somewhere else. Like, you expect to have the assembly line, you know, the assembly line just has to be able to go. But in a process firm, it was all the ones who were the high status were the ones who kept the plant operating and functioning. Because if you stopped production of in a process firm, which was like if you couldn't produce any more gasoline or couldn't produce any more of the chemical batch, then you had you had significant problems because those types of firms, when you shut down, it takes forever to reboot. Whereas an assembly line, the effects of shutting down are very different. The status, the expertise where it is, all of those were distributed differently among these firms.
Definitely. I think, we can make a distinction between the criticisms that were being discussed at the time of when Joan Woodward published her work, and that started off with a report, and the book is kind of an extension of the work that she did, including the report, but also the work afterwards. And there's a bunch of criticisms that emerged afterward within the broader context of how the contingency theory, the contingency approach emerged. And when we start off with the first, like, the most important criticism was about the legitimacy of the field of industrial sociology and org studies that was embedded in that, and how, as a field, we had to distinguish ourselves from others, and how, in terms of, you know, the work of Taylor, there was this focus on the one best way and prescribing this one best way to organizations based upon scientific studies. And the work of Joan Woodward and her colleagues was kind of perceived at the time as kind of undermining the body of knowledge that had been developed. So instead of perceiving it as there's not one best way, but there might be multiple ways, they saw it as, you know, we don't have anything to tell. And if you perceive that from a practice perspective, what they try to do at the time, or I guess what we're still struggling with as scientists and as academics, is the learning, how firms think they can learn about management is learning by doing. That was kind of the approach at the time. And of course, learning by doing is very important. But as a field, we also think we have something to say about, you know, how management can look like and how learning can happen, and that it doesn't always have to come from experience inventing the wheel over and over again.
Yes, I think one of the criticisms that we can make, it's somewhere, I don't remember where in the book she said that she was using the social anthropology methodologies, and I think it's very similar to what other social anthropologists were doing at the time, but they are recollecting what others saying about the organization. So I can think that 100 firms with all the authors going to every place, maybe it could be a weakness of the study, because we cannot control what the others are doing in the field. We know how making field work is something that it's difficult, and I don't know if you can process all this information coming from many researchers. So it's kind of, I think there is a great big distance between the author and the organizations that she studied.
And I thought some other criticism points was, on the one hand, this whole idea that performance is something that's actually not so difficult to, in that sense, define, because it depends always also on your interests. There's not one straightforward utility function there. And that, so to say, highlights also the limits of rationality, in that sense that you don't always know also what the alternatives are. You don't always know what the consequences are. You don't always know what all the interests are of all the people involved. So it's actually difficult to really say what actually helps with performance. There's also, of course, a problem that it kind of assumes that the world out there and the technology, et cetera, is just a given. But say, if you are in a world where technology is much more fluid and where your actions as a company might actually have impacts on the environment, on the market, on the technology, et cetera, it's not so easy to actually talk about fit anymore, because then your company and your environment, it's all becoming a bit more fluid. And that's the last criticism that I wanted to mention, is that the whole idea that contingency fit sounds in the end also quite static, as if there's one fit, so to say, for each company. While actually there's also, of course, a processual nature of the ongoing organizing that's happening in the company as things are changing. And highlighting this more processual nature of organizational structure that can also change over time, depending on how people are behaving in the company. This was some more of the criticism.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think Joan Woodward also acknowledges that in part in her work, especially when she talks about measuring technology and the difficulties they encountered there. Kind of the similar argument is true for that.
And many of the things that appears in the book are discussed by another type of literature that was around by the time of the book was released, and even after. I miss how organizations did things. Of course, there are some of these things on the part of the case studies, but I thought that what really missed the book is how decisions was made on the organizations that she studied. I think that changes are just the result of how technology was implemented, but not how people were choosing, how people inside organization was choosing between alternatives of technology.
We kind of identified some of the criticisms that were out there at the time when Joan Woodward published her book, as well as kind of the criticisms that emerged later, as kind of viewing her work as a little bit too technology deterministic. Yeah, like you said, Tom, how our insights as an academic field evolved over time. But nevertheless, I think this work is of remarkable importance. And I think Joan Woodward is an extraordinary woman. Starting her career at the University of Liverpool, then going to Essex Technical College, and then see later when this set of studies ended and the funding ended at Essex, she joined Imperial College London in 1958, and she actually became the second woman to be appointed as a chaired full professor there. And I think that's quite an achievement we should not forget, and yeah, something that we should acknowledge, and that's also an indication of the significance of her work. It's something to keep in mind as we move into part two, I think.
And that concludes part one of episode 60. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive via Twitter, Facebook, or through our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Please join us next time as we continue our discussion of Woodward's book, Industrial Organization, Theory and Practice, here on Talking About Organizations.